Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. I'm Dawn Davenport, your host and the director of Creating a Family. You can get more information about Creating a Family, as well as accessing all of our resources at our website, creatingafamily.org. Today, we're going to be talking about coping with pregnancy loss and miscarriage with Dr. Poonam Sharma. She is a licensed psychologist specializing in reproductive issues in San Antonio, Texas, and she is a member of the Mental Health Professional Group at the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Sharma. Thank you so much for being with us today to talk about what you and I both think is such an important issue, pregnancy loss and miscarriage.
Thank you, Dawn. I'm really happy to be here and to talk about this really important topic.
All right, part one, miscarriage and stillbirth statistics. The distinction between a miscarriage and stillbirth is a lot in timing. A stillbirth is the death of a baby before or during delivery. Both miscarriage and stillbirth describe pregnancy loss, but they differ according to when the loss occurs. So in the United States, a miscarriage is usually defined as the loss of a baby before the 20th week of pregnancy. And a stillbirth is a loss of a baby at 20 weeks of pregnancy or later. So about one pregnancy in 100 ends in stillbirth. And each year, if you want to kind of have a rough estimate of numbers, is about 24,000 babies are stillborn. Again, this is a stat for the United States. And for women who know they are pregnant, about 10 to 15 in 100 pregnancies, so that'd be 10 to 15%, end in miscarriage. And as many as half of all pregnancies may end in miscarriage, but we don't know the exact number because a miscarriage may happen before a woman even knows she's pregnant. And we'll be talking more about that later. And most miscarriages happen in the first trimester before the 12th week of pregnancy. Miscarriage in the second trimester between the 13th and 19th week of pregnancy happen in 1 to 5 in 100, so 1 to 5% of pregnancies. And the primary cause of first trimester miscarriage is chromosomal abnormalities. Dr. Sharma, what factors impact a woman's grief and how she responds to a pregnancy loss, be it a miscarriage or a stillbirth?
Well, I mean, there's many factors. Of course, starting with who she is as a person, her personality and, you know, how she copes with stressful situations in general, but also in this situation, how far along she is in the pregnancy, how the pregnancy loss happened. You know, I've worked with a number of patients where the pregnancy loss itself was very traumatic because they were alone and didn't have the support they needed to deal with, you know, the medical situation that they were being faced with. So those kind of factors can have an impact. Also, I do quite a bit of infertility work and sometimes just how long someone has been trying to have a baby. If there have been multiple losses, one after another, you know, sometimes it can feel like just too much. I mean, I've worked with some women who've had, you know, 10 losses in a row or something along those lines. And of course, very different from somebody, you know, who's had one. I mean, they're both losses and they both emotionally are tough, but the process of picking yourself back up and going at it again makes it challenging. So those are a few of the things that I can think of off the top of my head.
Do you think it matters how grief is processed and how a woman grieves, depending on the timing in the pregnancy of the loss, be it a early first trimester loss versus a something further along and even up to a stillbirth?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it has a lot to do with the connection a person has to the pregnancy. I often find, especially with the first time people have a miscarriage, it's often much, much harder because there's a lot more connection to the pregnancy, a lot more excitement, hope. And so there's a lot of focus on the pregnancy result. And when you go to a fertility clinic, you know, you may end up with a positive test, but then, you know, the pregnancy may end very shortly thereafter, and they call that a chemical pregnancy. And yet for the person, if they're focused and very connected to the pregnancy already, that is a loss, and they experience it can be devastating. So, and then of course, as the baby develops, most people will start to, at some point, start to connect with the baby itself. And some people even name the baby. They'll be certainly thinking about what the baby is going to look like. They may be talking about names and all those kinds of things. So the more you're going down that path of connecting with this baby that's growing, then of course, the harder the loss is on the back end. And so what I find is that if someone's had a miscarriage one time and they're trying to get pregnant again, there's often like a huge sense of caution because they don't want to get connected, really don't want to get wrapped up in it until they have a better sense of it being a pregnancy that will come to term.
How does the patient's age play in? I mean, we know that women, the older a woman is, the greater her chances of having a miscarriage, but also the less time she has to try again, and the greater the likelihood that the next pregnancy might also end in miscarriage. So how do you see a patient's age influence the way that, and of course all this is so independent because we all humans are so different, but how, if you could make some generalizations about how age might play into the grief process.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. If she's using her own eggs, then of course age has a whole other sort of biological implication there, and that the risks of miscarriage go up as eggs age, right? So if you're using an egg donor, then it's a little bit different. Even if you're older, you may have a different experience. But so, you know, I think age can be a positive in the sense that a person may have already lived through other difficult times in their lives, and so they may actually have more skills to cope with the grief that follows. This is where it becomes very, very individual. I mean, that you can have somebody who's 50 who's never really learned how to process a loss. You can also have someone who's 25 that came from a background where, you know, losses or other emotional situations were handled very openly, so they're going to be a lot more able to navigate the difficulties that come up with miscarriage or other pregnancy loss.
Well, and as you pointed out as your first statement, a person's temperament, some people are better able, are more resilient in general. So I think that also, as you say, that's irrespective of age. What about women who are experiencing miscarriage or pregnancy loss, but already have children or a child already? You know, secondary infertility is an area that I think that women who are experiencing secondary, I should say couples who are experiencing secondary infertility often feel one foot in and one foot out of both the parenting world and the infertility world. And I think it's a particularly lonely place to be, but in this question is the existence of children, because at least you know that you're going to have the parenting experience. Does that often act as a buffer, or the desire to provide your child with a sibling adds greater grief, and because you're disappointing not only yourself but your child as well?
You know, I think what can really add the pain is other people looking at you and saying, you know, you already have a child, so isn't that great? You know, and
yeah,
so
why are you complaining?
Exactly. That's actually more what it is, because I think when people come in for counseling around this, it's because they really feel so alone and they feel a sense of shame sometimes, like maybe I'm not allowed to have these feelings, you know, because I already have a child, right? Whereas someone else maybe doesn't even have a child. So maybe my pain, you know, I shouldn't be so overwhelmed by this. And yet, you know, your pain is your pain. And
well, yeah,
I say that a lot. Your pain is your pain. I can't really compare it to anybody else's pain. And you have a right to it and a right to, you know, have someone listen to that and honor it. Yeah.
Well, I also think that whether this is accurate in reality or not really doesn't matter. But I think a lot of people feel the pressure to provide a sibling, and so for their child. And
yes.
So the feeling of experiencing a loss, then you're denying your child something that you value, you think that they will value. And I think, but I don't, as you say, I don't think that the world necessarily acknowledges that.
Yes. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that many times when people are motivated to have a second child, they are also thinking about the first one, and they have a sense that I'm not going to be here forever, and I want my child to have somebody else in the world. That really can be a big driver. And so when they're not able to achieve that, there's not only the loss itself, but there's also the fear that's just still sitting there, my child's alone. You know, what if they don't have anybody to navigate life with? So, you know, I think both those sets of feelings are very real and need to be acknowledged.
And either they themselves have strong sibling connections, or they have an idealized version of what that would be. And therefore that also adds the pressure. And again, I think it makes it all the harder that because they have one, they don't feel that they can own and have the right to be overwhelmed and sad by this loss.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly how many people feel. They're often questioning that. Do I have a right to these feelings of sadness? Do I have a right to grieve? Because at least I have one child.
And
I mean, my answer is always, of course you do. Of course.
Yeah.
We all have to grieve anything.
Do you see the grief process play out differently if a woman or a man has others in their life that they can talk to about this experience and about the loss, families, friends, whomever, does it really not so much matter if they are able to talk and process it with somebody?
I think that you're pointing to something really critical, and that is, I mean, grief, often there's a massive social component to it. And one of the things I see when people are dealing with miscarriage, especially before the pregnancy was known to everybody else, they can just feel very invisible with their loss, right? And so having other people acknowledge the loss, offer comfort around it, can be really healing. It's extremely healing, which is why we have so many rituals around grief, you know, when someone dies. We have funerals, we have memorial services, you know, we send cards, we buy we give people food and, you know, so many cultures in the world. I mean, like I was, when my dad died, you know, about a decade ago. I remember my mom, I mean, it's like there's a whole year of mourning. You know, I'm of Indian background. And so there's all these rituals for years. So that social component is really important. And if you have people that you can literally just kind of show up and express how you feel without having to screen that, without, you know, a person that you feel really safe with, who you don't feel judged by, that's very, very healing for sure. That's what therapy essentially is. You know, it's a safe space to come and do that. When people don't have that in their own lives, or there's not enough of it, then they often find their way to a therapist to provide some of that and create a space to process their loss.
I was glad you raised the issue of pregnancy loss before others know. That is, many miscarriages happen that way, and certainly in the infertility world, they do as well, that it's very early, even before people have mentioned to others. And that's a weird place to be because you're going through something that is huge in your life, assuming it is, and most often it is, and yet people don't know, so you suffer alone or just with one partner.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the other thing that also happens, especially if it's before the pregnancy is more obvious, is that others minimize that loss, you know. They may say things like, you know, well, there's probably some sort of a genetic issue, so it's probably, you know, better this happened, you know, probably for the better, or at least it was really early. And those kinds of things, you know, I think people say those just try to comfort, but they unfortunately have the impact of making that person feel like their loss is diminished in some way. You know, it diminishes that experience for them, and it causes them to retreat. Then they're like, okay, I can't talk about this. You know, maybe I'm not supposed to be feeling all these feelings I'm having.
And it also makes them resentful of the people who are sharing that information.
Right.
Unhelpful information.
No, that's true. And this happens in all sorts of, you know, grief, right? I mean, people don't always know what to say, and they're trying to be helpful, but they sometimes show up saying things that actually add to your pain unknowingly.
Okay. And we'll be talking about that in just a minute.
Yeah.
All right. Let me pause for a moment to remind you that this show is brought to you in part through the generous support of our partners. These are organizations and clinics that believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. We could not be doing what we do without their support, and we thank them. One such partner is Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York. They are a full-service fertility center specializing in vitro fertilization, egg donation, egg and embryo freezing, LGBTQIA family building, reproductive surgeries, and male reproductive medicine. Highly individualized patient care is offered through 13 reproductive endocrinologists and fertility specialists, and a urologist, as well as a full support team. By combining the latest innovations in reproductive sciences with compassionate and customized treatment plans, RMA of New York is able to provide the very best possible care. So now let's talk about, we've talked about some of the things that people should not say, but let's talk about some of the common responses that you will hear. And I think it depends on the stage of pregnancy, but you will certainly hear, and I'm repeating some that you just mentioned, it happens, it's very common, you can try again, it's probably for the best, it wouldn't have survived, or the baby would have had all sorts of problems. So these are the type of things that people obviously, these are the type of things that people come out with and say. Why are those type of statements often not helpful? Maybe I should ask, are they helpful? Because they may be. Are they helpful for people?
That's really the question, right? I mean, I think they may not be helpful because we're kind of shooting in the dark. So I think it's always safest to just kind of, when someone is grieving or has gone through a difficult experience, to just go in with an open mind, knowing that you really don't know how they're experiencing it. You really don't know. And I think we have to be very careful not to project our own feelings on that person or our own ideas onto that person. It's very important to kind of approach them with an open mind and say, how are you doing? You know, I've been thinking about you. I know you went through this very difficult thing. How's it going? They may be doing okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a possibility.
Yeah.
Or they might not be. But I think that when you go in without a lot of assumptions about what it's going to look like, it just gives that person room to be able to talk more openly about their real experience.
Okay, so for those people who have someone in their life who has experienced a miscarriage, and then I'm going to ask the same question for stillbirth. For those people who have experienced a miscarriage, one of the things you say is don't make assumptions and go in and ask, how are you doing? Versus making assumptions on how they should be doing, because you point out they may be thinking, oh, well, you know, it's early on. I'm glad it happened early, not late. And I'm going to try again. You know, we'll start again next month. And, you know, that may be how they're coping, and it's healthy and they're doing well, but they may not be. And so you don't want to present that. And earlier you mentioned many societies, in fact, probably all societies, have rituals associated with with grief of all sorts. So what type of rituals can we do around something like a miscarriage? Because you're missing something that you don't have. You don't have a face. You didn't know this. You knew them emotionally, but you knew them. You knew this potential life or this life, based on your own hopes and not so much on the actual person that this would have been. So what type of rituals are helpful there?
Yeah, it depends on the nature, you know, the nature of the loss and how the person's experiencing it. But sometimes the ritual is actually just the couple doing some sort of ritual themselves. They, you know, people often have ultrasound pictures and things like that. I mean, I've had clients that have, you know, just sat and grieved with those together, or they've planted something, or I've had a few clients have bought, there's actually even jewelry out there that kind of, you know, acknowledges the loss, something you can wear to remind you. So I think the key is to design a ritual that actually feels healing to the people who are involved, right? And of course, as you know, the further along the pregnancy is, those rituals become more formalized, right? If you have a stillbirth, there's usually a funeral that comes after that. But I, So I think the key is just to design it and ask them, you know, what would be helpful to you. And they may or may not want, the couple may or may not want other people to participate on that. They may want to keep it to just themselves, or they may want close family members who are also really excited about the pregnancy and involved. So I think it's really important to just follow the lead of the individuals that are dealing with the loss.
One thing I will mention that I have seen so many women do that they have found very helpful, and this is only for those people who like tattoos, but getting a tattoo that somehow memorializes the existence of this child and has been very helpful for many women. And there are a number of designs available in all sizes and in everything you could imagine. There are just so many options available. So that's something that is very helpful for those people who want to be tattooed.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great way to market for somebody who wants that, right? Once again, so some people may want the tattoo, some may not, some may want something that visible, others may want it to be more private. So It's really about respecting whatever that person needs. That's really what we're talking about. It's like identifying what is the need and how can we help a person meet that, you know? And if it's a family member that's going through that, I mean, you can just really just say, is there anything, you know, we can do to help you heal? Once again, open-ended questions, more just exploring and just giving the message that I'm here for you. I care about you. And whatever you need, I'm going to support you in meeting that need.
And I'm sorry this happened. I'm sorry you're going through this.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's better just to say that, and honestly, because I think sometimes people work too hard. And it's so much more powerful sometimes just to say, I'm just so sorry, you know. It makes me sad to know that you're going through this.
Yes. Yeah. And I am here in your pain. If you have that, that's what I'm here for, just to be while you are suffering, while you are grieving.
Exactly.
Now, we've talked about miscarriage. And as you pointed out, that as the pregnancy progresses, it becomes the process of grief becomes different, if only because other people know about it. You may have already showed, so there is more, you either have to tell people, we haven't yet moved into stillbirth, I'm moving there, but in the second trimester before the 20th week, you're showing, you have, at that point, most people have told everyone in their life that they are pregnant. How does that change what others can do? Because it seems like that makes it, in some ways, it makes it better, because then at least people are acknowledging your loss and you're not alone in your loss. But on the other hand, you then have to repeat it 1,000 times, it feels like. So what can those around someone who is in their second trimester and you already know about the pregnancy, anything different or anything that you would add for how they can help them cope?
I think that as people know, they will feel more responsibility to at least check in. I think it gets a little trickier too as the pregnancy becomes more obvious, because you may get a lot more support in people because they know that you're pregnant. They know you've been through a loss, but you can also get more of the other side of it too. Maybe a coworker who doesn't quite know what to say to you, so they just don't say anything. You know, and they just kind of avoiding you all of a sudden, or the person who it's along those same lines, someone else who just never, ever even says anything about it. And yet you're interacting with them on a daily basis, or somebody who says something that they're intending to be helpful, but it's not so helpful. So, you know, I think that definitely the more visible the pregnancy is, then you'll get a whole range of responses to that. And in that, there'll be hopefully lots and lots of support that's actually helpful. And then there'll be a sprinkling of things that probably aren't. But I do think we have such a deep, deep need to be seen. It's a hardwired human need. And so that acknowledgement is really, really important.
What are some of the rituals that we now, I don't think it has always been the case, but with a stillbirth, what are some of the rituals that in the hospital and outside the hospital, we now encourage families to partake in to help them grieve this loss?
Yeah, I think hospitals now actually do a really wonderful job of allowing people to spend time with a baby after it's passed. There's even some people who do photography, you know, and I think do a beautiful job of honoring a very painful moment and capturing it. You know, I think it's, they're trying to help. It's all comes down to acknowledging that this was really a life that was here, right? And marking that in some way. And so I find, you know, what the hospitals do these days in terms of allowing photography, allowing people to spend time holding the baby. I mean, those are really, really powerful healing experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too. And as you mentioned, often a funeral is a part of that. And so then that falls into our traditional grief and mourning rituals, which that we can then move directly into.
That's right.
All right. Now, I want to talk specifically for infertility nurses. And I want to start because often it is, not always, but it often can be the infertility nurse who has the responsibility of sharing the news that the embryo is, or the zygote or the fetus is no longer viable. This is only in the first, usually the first trimester losses as the infertility nurse involved. So let's talk some about that process of sharing the news that the test has come back and the pregnancy is not viable. What are some things that nurses can do when they know they're going to be having to share this news? The first question I would have is, should this news be shared over the phone? Should you ask the patient and the patient to come in? If the patient is in a partnered relationship, should the partner come in? Let's talk about some of the practicalities that can make it easier, both for the patient as well as for the nurse.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, when I counsel people who are expecting, you know, results from a pregnancy test or, you know, or possibly expecting bad news from some medical procedure, it, as much as you can introduce some element of control into the process, is going to be helpful to the patient, because none of us want to be blindsided, right? So if there is some difficult news, it can sometimes be helpful just to give the person a bit of a heads up. Hey, you know, I want to talk to you about something. You know, when would be a good time, versus just calling and then just not really checking in to see where that person is, what's going on, whether they're alone or somebody's around, and then just giving them the news. So I think being very mindful of that, you really need to kind of, before you share any information, you really need to assess, where's that person? Literally, are they at work? Are they at home? Is there a spouse around or not? So there's not a blanket answer in terms of how to do it, but it's more, once again, like just trying to find out, you know, what's going on, then also trying to actually schedule time maybe to talk. And you can even ask them, you can say, you know, would you like to talk on the phone, or would you like to talk, you know, come to the clinic? Would you like your partner to be there or not? I mean, sometimes they need to go talk to their partner first before they can make that decision. But anywhere we can help a person feel like they have some choice, have some sense of control, that's going to help them feel better.
But of course, if you're sharing this, if you're calling it up and saying, I need to talk to you, would you like to come in? Or do you want us to talk on the phone? Do you have anybody with you? You're already telling them, aren't you? I mean, at this point, they're anticipating bad news. Yeah.
But you're also not getting into the weeds on it. So you're giving them a chance to kind of contain themselves some and make some decisions. You know, they may, you know, decide to go home at that moment and then call you back. You know, you're still giving them some input into the process. That's right.
I know some clinics ask before an IVF procedure is even done, before an embryo is transferred, how do you want to receive the results? And do you want it to be on the phone? And I do think that's really helpful to have this information in advance. But fewer of them deal with the possibility of after a pregnancy has been established and is no longer viable. I guess you could go back and assume that the same information, they would want the information shared in the same way. So you do have that. If the information has been gathered in advance, you do have that as an infertility nurse to fall back on.
Right. And usually if there's a miscarriage happening, I mean, a person is coming into face-to-face contact with a medical professional, you know, that's helping them through. That's often the case. So, you know, when they're there with you, then of course, I mean, kindness, gentleness, being compassionate, all those things to help anybody when they're suffering definitely come in. You know, what I find a lot, though, is, I've worked with several fertility clinics over the years, and I talk to a lot of nurses, and I hear how much pain they feel as well. Mm-hmm. When their patients are going through a hard time, they really feel it too. And so I think it'd be really tricky sometimes because you're feeling awful for them yourself as a nurse. Mm-hmm. And, you're about to break this news to them and you don't want to inflict pain. I mean, mm-hmm. by definition, a nurse is usually trying to help you feel less pain and less mm-hmm. suffering. So I think it can be really hard trying to manage your own feelings about the loss and processing those a little bit before you like open things up with a patient, because then you really have to stand in this space of supporting them 100%, you know, it being about them.
Mm-hmm. So if they are there in person, obviously if there's a medical procedure, if something is, this is not a test result of a lack of viability, or if they are there and less infertility nurses, but other nurses are often in the room when a heartbeat is right. not found. So mm-hmm. that then you are then trying to just be with somebody in their pain and let them know and ask them how they want you to respond. Do you want me to be in here? Would you like some time alone with your partner? What would be helpful? Mm-hmm. That type of information. Right, exactly. Would that be what you would recommend?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, usually, you know, when there's an ultrasound going on, you're looking, you know, to see if the pregnancy is still viable. Patient usually knows something's up. They can read people's faces,
exactly.
you know, and so they often already know something's up. And I think a medical professional going into a situation like that where someone's coming in because they're, you know, having spotting or something like that, they know it's a possibility as well. Mm-hmm. So they can mentally kind of prepare a little bit before they even walk in the room. But yes, that's right. After it's clear that there is a loss or things are not looking good, you know, asking people what they need. That's always a safe bet, honestly, with a mm-hmm. lot of this. You can just kind of breathe, settle yourself and just let someone know you care and say, what can I do to help you right now? You know, what do you need? And most of the time people will tell you. They'll actually just tell you. That's one of the things of psychologists. I mean, I do a lot of exploring. I do a lot of what are your needs? Let's talk about those, because it does vary from person to person. And yet we all know that there's suffering. We're all helped by kindness and gentleness and somebody telling us that they care. That is universal.
Yeah. I heard a woman who had gone in for tests and it turned out that the pregnancy was no longer viable. And a nurse brought in a heated blanket and wrapped it around her. And she said it was the single, this was years later. And she said, even to this day, I cry thinking of the compassion that she thought of at that moment to do for me. And, it's a small act, but it many years later, it was the thing that this patient remembered.
Yeah, I can see that. It's just like a really warm hug, you know, I bet at some level. And just the kindness of somebody thinking of your needs at that level. Mm-hmm. And I just want to add, I think as healthcare professionals, it's actually also okay to let people see that you're moved. I think it's very powerful. You know, if someone's telling me a really painful story, I might be moved to tears listening to it. But in that moment, they feel seen. I mean, mm-hmm. they know that, oh, wow, this person gets how much this hurts. You know, so I think, you know, you don't want to be the one who's now crying and they're taking care of you, but I think just letting yourself be human in that moment. I mean, these moments when we have loss, when we're in pain, they can be very, very difficult moments, but they can also be times when you get a lot closer, like to the healthcare professionals that are taking care of you, because you know they care, you know, they're standing there with you and they're just with you in your loss. They may not be saying anything, but they're in the room. They're connecting with you as a human being.
Why do you think that some medical professionals feel that they need to not show emotion, that it would be more helpful to just trying to treat this as a matter of fact thing and not show emotions? From my personal experience, I see that more often with doctors than nurses, but I would imagine it would go both ways. What is the mentality thinking there? Because they're not trying to be cruel. I'm assuming at that point they're trying to be what they perceive as helpful?
Yeah, they might, you know, I think it depends on the person and their own background, how comfortable they are with their own emotions. Sometimes people see that as part of being professional. Like I used to work mm-hmm. in a hospital, and sometimes I would be in my office and someone would call me to come and because there was something going on. And it was like some, you know, a patient was crying and so they were bringing in the psychologist, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like, it was something where if someone had just been kind and handed the person a tissue, it probably would have been enough. But I think sometimes people don't know what to do. They're not trained about how to manage these kinds of situations. So so unless they've got some good instincts or they've had some good experiences in taking care of other people emotionally, they just might not know what to do. And so sometimes what you see on the healthcare professional end is just an awkwardness.
Yes.
And okay, mm-hmm. so let's just kind of move on to the next thing, right? So.
Mm-hmm. But I do think that from an infertility nurse perspective, that developing this skill, or at least coming up with a grab bag of ideas of how you can respond that would be helpful is a good strategy, because you know that you're going to be in the position of helping people cope either with a negative pregnancy test or a loss of a pregnancy at some point. So having some yeah. skills, working on developing those skills would be helpful.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the other piece of that is sometimes we think we need to do something. You know, I think when you look at the medical system, I mean, there's a lot of interventions. And then you look at the infertility treatment, you know, you're doing IVF, you're doing IUIs, so lots of things that people can do. And when you bump up against a loss, it's like there's nothing you can do except for just kind of be with that person, tend to their needs, take care of them. So it is about getting comfortable with just the emotional aspect of it, because there's nothing you can do to fix the fact that this person had a loss, and it's painful. And so just I think learning how to just kind of be there without saying or doing tons, but being helpful in the sense of assessing that person's needs, right? I mean, even basic stuff like, you know, encouraging patients to make sure, you know, when they are going home, you know, make sure you're getting enough rest, you know, you're eating and drinking and just making sure they have a little support around them, those practical things can be very, very helpful. But, you know, we are made to heal. We are made to heal. And I think sometimes we forget that. We feel like we have to do something when it's really, we just need to be together with the person who's been hurt. And we need to help them create an environment where that healing can happen. Because our bodies, our minds, they know how to heal. We just have to create conditions for that to happen.
Does it factor in with some medical professionals that a pregnancy loss is also a failure on their part, that their job was to help you get pregnant, and now you are not pregnant. So either they failed, or one way to perceive that would be, okay, I failed. And then they respond mm-hmm. out of their sense of failure, which is almost always not going to be helpful for the person who is suffering the loss.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the healthcare professional may feel disappointed, right? They may mm-hmm. feel disappointed too that this didn't work. They may be grieving at some level themselves as well. And so, yeah, it can be very, very tough, especially I think most people that work with patients really care about their patients. They want, you know, if a person comes in, they want to get pregnant, but the healthcare professional wants that for them too. And so, yes, they're also going through their own disappointment. And sometimes people cope with that by, you know, just being very, very matter of fact about it, or trying to figure out what's the next thing we can do. They may get into problem solving mode, which is what helps them feel better, but it may not help the patient feel better right in that moment. You know, there may be a time for problem solving. I'm not saying it's a bad strategy, but, you know, when someone's hurting, they often can't go there with you.
So. Great segue into what I was next going to ask is oftentimes people do want to say, okay, well, you know, we're going to, you know, we'll get back on that horse. We're going to start again. We will, you know, let's come in and let's talk about the next options that you've got. How, when should the problem solving, as you say, which is the perfect way of saying it, when should that start, when somebody is either fresh with the news or even still grieving a month later? How do we help our patients move to the next step if that's what they want?
Yeah, I mean, I think once again, check in, so I know you've been through a really difficult time, and, you know, everybody needs time to absorb a loss. Where are you guys? Do you feel ready to start to talk about next steps, or would you rather wait? Do you want to give me a call back when you're ready? You know, once again, checking in and letting them take the lead on that. And because I find, especially with the infertility work I do, you know, it's easy to keep the medical process going. Okay, well, we have one failed IVF. And okay, let's go back. Oh, he had a miscarriage. Well, let's try again. You still have three or four embryos left, right? And yet, you can keep going on the medical end, but then there's the emotional process too. Mm-hmm. And people move at different paces in the emotional process. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, they do want to, they're like, okay, give me a couple of weeks or give me a month. We're going to be back and we're going to like go on to the next cycle or whatever it is. Other times, you know, they really can't move that fast. This may be somebody who has had other significant losses in their life and they really do need a longer amount of time to pick themselves up. So, you know, I think we just need to be aware that those two paths can sometimes, you know, operate at very different paces.
And different patients have a different tolerance for how much pain they want to put themselves potentially through. It's also possible that they would decide, I don't want to do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely right. I think when there is a moment like this, right, when you've experienced a loss, that's actually a time. I always encourage people to take a little time, absorb the loss, and then just pause and ask themselves, okay, what do I want to do next versus just jumping on to the next thing because there's social pressure to do that or nobody's asking, right? A lot of times patients are looking for healthcare professionals to lead the way and they'll just keep following, right? So sometimes if the healthcare professionals aren't also pausing and say, hey, are you doing okay? I mean, do you feel ready to take this next step or do you feel like you need a little time? You know, because we can wait, you know, there's no hurry here whenever you're ready, right? And sometimes when a nurse might say that or a doctor might say that, then the patient might feel, oh, I've got some permission, you know, to really see what my needs are.
Yeah, I call it the infertility treatment escalator, because so often once you get on, the next step is coming at you and you either raise your foot to step on it or you're going to fall. And that's oftentimes not from an emotional standpoint, the very best. We need to allow that. Just because we as medical professionals perceive that the next step is obvious and logical and we will try again, doesn't mean that that's where the patient emotionally is.
That's right. And I think that's a great metaphor. In fact, as you were saying that about the escalator, I thought, yeah, you could actually get off the escalator and take the steps. You could sit on the steps for a while if you want to.
Exactly.
But you don't want to go up those steps. You know, you just stay where you are. So it is about like getting out of, you know, the automated process, right? And being much more conscious and deliberate and mindful and making a real decision about what's best for you.
Yes, absolutely. And now I want to talk about compassion fatigue, because nurses, in infertility nurses and all nurses, often face a great deal of grief in their patients. Either for an infertility nurse, it may be the failure to get pregnant, or it could be a pregnancy loss. So what are some ways that nurses, infertility nurses, can, well, first of all, let's talk about what are some ways that compassion fatigue can display itself? How do we know if we are suffering from compassion fatigue?
Yeah, so compassion fatigue tends to be kind of a more extreme version of burnout. I mean, you really just, you might notice like that you're numb and not as kind of, you know, compassion fatigue, the person is really trying to stay connected, but and emotionally, but not able to anymore. There's truly a sense of fatigue. So I think disconnection can be part of it. All the signs that actually show up with depression can end up there. You may not be sleeping very well, your appetite's off, just may feel blah about things in general, just feel like you don't have anything to give anymore, you know, just there's just a change in how you feel at work. You're just not, you're not the professional that you know that you normally are. You know, it feels really, really off from that.
You might feel that you're not as emotionally connected with your patients. That's another symptom for some nurses. And the opposite could be true, where you're feeling overly connected and not able to provide some distance. So both of those can be symptoms of compassion fatigue as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. That's right.
So what can nurses do, infertility nurses in specific, to help them cope with sometimes a sad job because they are sitting with people in times of grief? So how can they take care of themselves to prevent burnout or compassion fatigue?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Dawn, because, you know, the healthcare environment has become increasingly challenging, I think, for all healthcare professionals. A lot more pressure on everybody to see more patients, especially the larger fertility clinics have such high volume that it's humanly, I think, impossible to show up with tons and tons of compassion for every single person that walks in the door, because we have emotional limits ourselves, right? We're not robots. And so much as you're able to, really setting some boundaries around, you know, when you leave work, like really leaving work, if it's possible to do that, which is hard in fertility clinics. They're open all the time, you know, at some level. But really taking time for yourself so that when you're not at work, what are you doing to refuel? What are you doing to get away from the job, to actually connect with things that energize you, that help you feel alive? Even, you know, if you have an option to manage the number of hours that you work, that can be an important part of boundary setting. Even me as a therapist, I have the same issue. I am using, you know, part of how I do my work is I connect with my clients. I'm present as a human being, but there's a limitation there, right? And so I only see a certain number of people a day. So if you have any control over how much patient care you actually provide, or even the nature of the care, I mean, some aspects of the job may not require as much emotional connection.
Yeah, and that's very true.
You trade off somebody else for a little bit, do something a little bit more mundane.
And if you are in a position that you can talk with the powers that be and see this as an issue amongst the staff, to raise it and to realize that perhaps the it doesn't always have to be the same nurse who is calling and sharing bad news, or that the doctors may be able to do that with, you know, that they also step in to share some of that burden, or that after you've had to do that for once or twice, you know, that you pass that on so that it's not so that you can protect your staff from compassion fatigue.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, and some in the United States, I mean, this is a bigger issue. But, you know, many of us don't take even the vacation that we've earned. And I think it's so important to just literally just get away from everything for a while. It just, you go back and, you know, get away and refuel and come back, and you come back with a different perspective. So much of it is about day-to-day self-care, but then in the bigger picture also, stepping away from work and going into other aspects of your life to refuel you. I also think connection at work can be another source of, you know, keeping things healthy.
Such a good point.
Make friends that you have. I mean, sometimes if everyone's in a difficult situation together, it's so much easier to bear it, right? So I'm making sure you're in a work environment that's healthy and not too dysfunctional.
That is such a good point. From having talked with many infertility nurses, I know that when they have people that they can confide in and work, friends, it makes a difference because that is somebody who knows exactly what you're going through, and they can have your back in ways that people outside who haven't experienced what you're experiencing wouldn't know. So that is such a good point. And also good for those who are managing infertility nurses to think about how we create an environment that is supportive of each member as well as our patients. Because if we support the nurses, ultimately that is in the best interest of our patients as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's all about connection. I mean, I guess that may be part of the theme today. It's all about connection, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Dr. Poonen Sharma, for being with us today to talk about pregnancy loss and miscarriage. It's a topic that we need to do more talking about. Let me pause here to mention that the views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Also, keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility or mental health professional. If you are listening and you haven't subscribed to the Creating a Family podcast, please do us a favor and subscribe. It helps us and it helps you because you will be notified of all the upcoming shows. And it's easy and, of course, free. So go ahead, hit the subscribe button. Thanks for joining me today, and I will see you next week.